If you guys could tweet about the session, that's the Windows Phone hashtag, but also put the session number and AU TechEd in there as well. Good to get some more people across. If you weren't in my previous session, this QR code, basically go through to there to a registration site for more information around the local Windows Phone community, events, access to tokens, those types of things. Great resource for that. Just before we get started, if you didn't hear my previous session, there is a registration site for people interested in getting early access to the Windows Phone 8 SDK. I do apologize for those people who came to the session on Wednesday. We can't talk about the Phone SDK at the moment. That's completely under wraps until they go public with more information about it. Okay. This session is quickly called Sounds Like a Windows Phone Application. And originally was geared towards to be more speech orientated, so talking about various libraries coming forward in the new SDK. Unfortunately, we're not able to talk about those, so it's basically going to be a more in-depth look at doing some stuff around Windows Phone. So we're going to do a bit of each end of the life cycle of building a Windows Phone application. We're going to look at some hardcore design stuff, so things like the long list selector and how you can work with those to make your application look like a real phone application, and then we're going to go through and look at some of the testing aspects and how you can actually go about making your application more testable, use some of the testing tools that are available, and actually how you could wire this into your continuous integration systems if you wanted to. For those who don't know me, my name is Nick Randolph. I do a lot of work around Windows Phone and Windows 8. I run a company called Built to Roam, and we do primarily mobile software. So the agenda looks a little bit like this. We're going to start off in Blend, and we'll oscillate a bit between Blend and Visual Studio to try and get that designer-developer feel going. We're also going to look at how we can use the Windows Azure mobile services to actually use that as the back end for our Windows Phone application. And what's nice about that is that I'm going to show you how you can take the current SDK, which is only available for Windows 8 development, how you can look at what introspect what it's doing, and actually how you can actually create your own wrapper for it. I do have a wrapper that's actually on NuGet now, that basically does some very basic stuff, but I'll show you how you can use Fiddler to basically work out what the real library does in the absence of one coming from Microsoft. My understanding is that they are working on Windows Phone, and they're going to look at iOS and Android development for supporting those mobile services on Azure. Okay. And lastly, we're going to look at testing. Again, I'll reiterate the concepts around MVVM, and we'll look at how we can use the emulator for integration with our continuous build system. So, NuGet. How many people here use NuGet? Okay, so quite a few of us are relatively familiar with it. This is a really convenient way for Microsoft and other people to actually distribute libraries and packages and frameworks for people to use like ourselves within our applications. And the main one that nearly everyone uses in Windows Phone is, of course, the Silverlight Toolkit for Windows Phone. It gives you things like the long list selector, it gives you list picker, it gives you wrap panel. There's a whole bunch of nice controls that are part of that Silverlight Toolkit that are available via NuGet now. Okay, so you don't need to go to the Codeplex site. They still maintain the Codeplex site with documentation and information about the Silverlight Toolkit, but the easiest way to get it now is actually via the NuGet package. And there's a bunch of other libraries and frameworks that I would like to call out. MVVM Lite, the Silverlight Unit Testing Framework, and no, I'm not going to use the abbreviation in this presentation, but you can guess what it is. And then there's the continuous integration library that's also in NuGet. And essentially, the WP7CI actually wraps up the testing framework to make it more usable in a corporate environment. Okay. So our number one demo is going to be on actually using NuGet. So I'm going to create a new application. And we'll call this Sounds Like Windows Phone. Silverlight Windows Phone. Okay, we're going to pick the 7.1 application. So this is our project, and what we're going to do is go right-click on there and go Manage NuGet Packages. And I've actually got these as part of my recently used packages, so it should pull out the Windows Silverlight Toolkit for Windows Phone. I can click Install, click OK, and you'll notice that it goes ahead and adds references. It also adds in the some icons into here as well. So it and these are the icons that are actually used by certain pages within the toolkit. So for example, if you use the date time picker, the OK and cancel buttons are actually taken out of those ones, and they provide those as part of the NuGet package, so you don't forget to include them in your application. I've seen a number of people who have gone through testing phases, and people click on a date time, and then they've got these little square icons with a cross through them, where it basically can't find the icons in the app bar. By doing this, installing the NuGet package, you actually get those icons for free, that is part of the deployment package. Okay, so from here, the other thing I'm going to do in here is add a reference, and I want to add a reference to the controls library, because we're going to use one of the controls that's actually part of that, which is, of course, the panorama. And because I don't do design stuff in Visual Studio, I'm going to switch across to Expression Blend. And so the link there was right-click on the solution on the project, and she got open in Expression Blend. It actually opens our project for us. This is the basic layout of a page. Unless you're building a static, single, standalone page, I tend to get rid of most of that content. And in this case, we're actually going to go and create a panorama. And I'm just going to double-click on that. And so within Blend, there's a number of different ways that you can take things from the asset window or from the toolbar on the right, on the left-hand side there, and actually add them to your project. The one I did then was just double-click on it. You could also drag it from this assets window straight onto the objects and timeline, which gives you your visual hierarchy in the application. Or you can actually drag it onto the design surface and decide to size it up that way. The panorama should take up the full screen. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, Blend decides that it's not going to take up the full screen. So you can right-click on there, auto-size, and go fill. Okay, so that's the easiest way to do it. It saves you having to go to the properties dialog and actually reset or change all of the widths and heights and things like that. So that's taking up the full screen now. Of course, we don't have any data to actually present in here. So we're going to come across to the data window over here and go, give me some new sample data. And this is going to be my photos sample data. Okay, and I'm going to enable that while I'm running. Now, before we go on, what I want to do is actually flip across and to give you a bit of an idea of what we're going to, the type of thing that we're going to be building. Let me flip to 2. Okay, so I've got this. This was a little sample app that I built. It's called Geek or Nerd, and the concept is very straightforward. Okay, the idea is that you basically take a photo, you push it up onto the, you basically add a comment to it, and I'm going to take a quick photo the room. Let's put it back there. I'll go accept. And as soon as we come back to this page, what you'll see is a progress bar basically pushing that. Let's see if we can get a little bit better focus on that. The progress bar is basically pushing it up to the web. I'm going to add a bit of a comment to this. Windows Phone session. And save those. Okay, so that's uploaded that successfully, so I'll come back out of there, and if I do a refresh on this, what we should see is that the that image will appear on the bottom of this list. There you go. Now, behind the scenes, what it's done in the web is actually taken it from being a relatively large photo to actually scale it down to 173 by 173, which ironically is the same size as the, not at all ironically, as the start tiles. Okay, so the idea there is that you could then push that out to people who have also got the app. Okay, I can then go and, well, let's pick the right one. For some reason it's picking the wrong one. Anyway, the idea there is that we're building up a list of items, okay, that we can then vote on. Okay, so the reason I wanted to talk through that is basically because it will make a whole bunch more sense when we actually get on to connecting up and building out the mobile services a bit later on. Coming back to our design, what it means is that we need a way of presenting that list of items. Are you able to? Wait 2 seconds. At least it's not funky colours. There we go. Good. Okay, so what we're going to do is actually build up a collection of these items and actually display them within this application. And we're going to actually present it two different ways. Okay, so this is going to be our photos list. And in here, we're going to change this to image URL. Okay, and we're going to change the type of this design time data to be an image. And the next one is going to be our comment, okay? Because for each photo that gets uploaded, there's going to be a corresponding comment. And I'm just going to increase the length of those comments. And if I go into this button here, I can actually modify the amount of design time data that actually gets generated. And the reason why I'm going to do this is because I want to show you what happens with a list box if you get a lot of content in it, and why you should then look at using the long list selector. Okay, so I'll click OK. So that's generating me quite a bit of data. I'm just going to drag that straight onto there. Okay, I'm going to do right-click on there, go auto size, and do fill. Okay, so again, same thing we did with a panorama, just do it on the list box to make sure it takes up the full amount of space. I'm going to come across here. I don't particularly like the layout that's currently there, so I'm going to go and modify the item template. Now, the default template it gives me, and I'm actually going to show you the XAML here, is that it gives us a stack panel, so a vertical stack panel, basically listing the two items. Not a big fan of that, so I'm actually going to change that to change the layout type. And the reason why I wanted to do all of these steps is not because they're particularly complex, but if you haven't seen somebody do all of this stuff, then you're kind of left scratching your head and you're trying to start writing XAML to change it from a stack panel to a grid. Okay, there are easy ways of doing it without actually having to start writing the XAML. So I go grid. The other reason I wanted to show you this is because if you do that, it can introduce some XAML that you weren't expecting. So for example here, it's added a height and a width property, and I apologize to the guys at the back, it's probably a bit small. It's introduced a height and a width property or attributes on the elements that you probably don't want. Okay, so what we're going to do here is on this grid, we're actually going to say auto size and we're actually going to say both, and that's going to get rid of those properties for us. I could have just deleted them in the XML as well. Okay. The other thing we're going to do is now that this is a grid, we're actually going to size it. I'm going to put a column in here. Okay, so that's one option. My preferred mechanism is, you see how it's actually said, okay, down here in the column definitions, it's basically made them a ratio, okay? So it's basically said, okay, well, the part on the left should be this ratio and the part on the right should be this ratio. I don't particularly want that. I want the part on the left to be fixed size. I want it to be 100 by 100, okay? Whereas the right-hand side, I don't care how big that is. Okay, it's actually a little bit harder to do that in the designer. So quite often what I'll do, and let me just undo that, is I'll go to properties, and this is for the grid. I'll come down here, and if you expand out this layout region, it actually lists the column definitions here. So if I click into there, I go boom, boom, there's my two columns. I click there, go back to it, and change this from star to being pixels, add in 100 into there, and I'm done. Okay, so now I have two columns. It doesn't look like I've got two columns, but bear in mind all of the content is currently in the first column. I do have the two columns there. The second column basically is designed to take up the remainder of the space. Okay, so what we need to do with each of these is basically adjust their layout slightly. So we actually want the text block to be on the right-hand side, so I'll set that to column one. And whilst I'm dealing with that, I'm actually going to change the style of it and apply a resource and set it to normal style. Let's bump it up a little bit. Let's actually set it to a slightly larger style, so we've got large style. And I'll also come down here and show you in the text properties, I'm actually going to get that to wrap. Okay, so it's going to bump out the text a little bit. The other thing I'm going to do is see how I don't particularly like the way it's presenting that image. I'm going to say, okay, well, the image actually I want to fix size 100 by 100. Okay, I want it to be aligned at the top. And you notice that there's actually a margin that's added on there. Okay, so Blend's really good at adding margins and borders and, you know, heights and widths when you're unexpected. So just be a little bit aware of the XAML that it's actually generating. And we'll actually add in a little bit of margin just so it does align properly with the top of the text. Right, the other thing you'll notice, again, focusing on alignment and making sure that you actually attention to detail. Okay, if you actually look at the left-hand side of this image, it's actually not aligned with the titles above it. Okay, so let's actually inject a little bit more space around this whole thing. And I'm not going to just inject side space on this particular element. I'm also going to put space between the items. Okay, so and to do that, system resource, phone margin, will actually add a 12-pixel spacing around all edges. Okay, there's some other resources in there for horizontal margin, so that just puts the space on the edge. There's vertical margin that just puts it top and bottom. Okay, so this margin will basically put it on all four sides. And you'll notice when you start to do some Windows Phone stuff that the actual, you know, the spacings are all in units of 12. So 12, 24. The border, the spacing at the edge should actually always be 24 around the perimeter for your actual content. And then spacing between things is done on a 12-pixel grid. So we've got our list box looking pretty good. Let me just bring this down. That's looking okay. Let's leave that one. Let's actually come back out of our template. So you'll notice over here we're still in this item template mode. Let's come back out of there. And what we're going to do is switch over to the second panorama item. Okay, so by actually switching, you know, I'm actually moving between those. The design time experience actually reflects what I'm currently editing. I'm going to go back to my data window, and again, I'm going to drag this onto this particular item. I'm going to drag that onto there. I'm going to tell this one that I want to, again, I'm going to auto size it. But this time, when I go and edit the template, I'm actually going to get rid of all of the content. Hang on. Let's just go edit additional templates, item template, edit current. Okay, I'm going to completely delete that stack panel, and I'm going to go hub tile. Okay, so this is part of the Silverlight toolkit. Okay, it's a big funky object. Okay, let's add some space onto that for a start. So let's just do 12 to the left and 12 to the bottom. Okay, so a bit of space there. And actually, let's wire this up to some items of our data. So we're going to go and click on the data binding option for the source. Okay, so the source is basically the image that will appear on the hub tile. And you'll notice that it's remembered the data context that we're in. Okay, so it knows that with the options that we've got to pick from are the comment and the image URL. And click the image URL, we get our image. Let's click the title, and we'll go data binding, and we'll go comment. Okay, so that's given us our title. And we're going to get this sort of flicking behavior, so it's sort of going to bounce. Now, this is kind of giving us that tile look, but the tiles are in a vertical list. That's not particularly great. So let's actually go and say, okay, well, actually, we don't want it in a vertical list, so we're going to go and modify the items panel, okay? The thing about ListBox and a lot of these listy type controls is that they have a number of different templates that you can modify. In this case, we're going to go and modify the items panel, which basically determines how the items are positioned relative to each other. Now, the default one is a vertical stack panel, okay, so item after item after item. A simplest approach would be to modify this to actually do a stack panel horizontally. Okay, so you just change the orientation property on the stack panel. So let's actually just do that quickly. So I'm going to go and create a new item template. A new items panel template. Okay, and it will inject the default one into there. So it basically, it's given us a stack panel. If I change this orientation to equals horizontal, all of a sudden it gives us horizontal. It's still not exactly that hub experience that we're really looking for. Okay, the ideal is if we're looking for something that's similar to the people hub, is that we want a tiled array that basically goes, it wraps. Okay, there must be a control for this. Let's delete the stack panel, and actually if we go wrap panel, there it is, wrap panel. So that's basically wrapping our items, and at the moment it's wrapping horizontally, so it's basically going 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, like that. But we're going to go elongate this, okay, so we're going to make it go horizontally. So we don't want it going all the way out there to infinity. We actually want to wrap vertically, so 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, and build it out that way. So let's actually change the orientation of that to vertical. Oh, hang on, we're back to a vertical list. The reason for this is because the list box thinks that it's going to go on vertically, right? So the scroll mode on it is basically set to automatic. So it means that if you go vertically, it's going to add a scroll bar and it's automatically going to scroll it. So we actually need to disable that behavior. So let's come back to our list box. We'll go down to these properties down in here, and you'll see that there is this horizontal scroll mode, scroll visibility, okay? Sorry, vertical scroll visibility. If I change that to disabled, all of a sudden we're getting close to the behavior we want. The issue here is that, okay, the panorama item hasn't resized to accommodate the content. So what we actually need to do is we need to tell the panorama item itself that it needs to scale that horizontally as well. So if I click back to the panorama item, there's this orientation property. If I click on that horizontal, that will give us that ability to scale out. What we're going to do is actually put a maximum width on it. So I'm going to say, okay, scale out to 900. And now you can see that it's actually going to size to do just that. So let's actually give this a bit of a whirl. Okay, we'll run it up in the emulator. So just hitting F5 in Blender will run it in the emulator, the same as in Visual Studio. And what we should see is our design time data. Okay, so there's our list. If I scroll over here, we've got our hub tiles that are basically arranged like they would on the core platform. The thing about this list is that, okay, it's really cumbersome for us to scroll through, okay? And we've only got 100 items, but what happens if we had 1,000 items in here, okay? It's not going to be a particularly great experience. What would be nice is if we could jump around this list. Now, just for the purpose of this demo, what we're going to allow people to jump by alphabet number. And the reason why this is convenient is because it actually mirrors what the core platform does for the people hub, which is the kind of experience that I wanted to build up to show you how easily you can do that. So we're going to come back to our list box, and the list box item, list box is, we basically push the list box as far as we can. Okay, that, there's no ability to do that jumping style interaction with the list box unless you were to build on it yourself. So what we're going to do is we're going to use the long list selector. Okay, I'm going to grab one of those and double click on that. It's going to add it to the same grid as the current list box, and I'm literally going to copy the references for the item template and the item source from the list box into the long list selector. And in the process, I'll auto size the list box so it takes up the screen. Oh, hang on, wait on, what's going on? We've got no content. The long list selector expects the items to be grouped. Okay, there's a quick fix to this, which is that we can come down here on the long list selector, and there is a property on here called is flat list. Now, if I do that, close the main page, reopen it, it will actually present it as a list of items. Right, so we've gone from one list to another list. Okay, that's not what we really wanted to do, right? What we wanted to do is actually have that jump list behavior. Right, so in order to do that, we actually need our content, like the items in the list, to be in grouped, okay? So it needs to be grouped somehow. So let's go back here and actually say, okay, we're going to change this to be grouped. So we can get rid of this isFlat property. Okay, so when this refreshes, it's not going to show any items again. Okay, so what we need to do is change the item source to being a set of grouped items. Now, there's a couple of ways that you can do this. In your code, you can write a whole bunch of code that actually surfaces up a grouping and actually exposes it to the item source property, so you could essentially data bind to that. What we're going to do today is actually I'm going to use a value converter to take our existing list, run it through a grouping, and spit out a group. Okay, so in order to do that, we need to write some serious code. Actually, we don't need to write that serious code. I've already got that code, so I'm going to drop it in and walk you through it, because trust me, you don't want to see me write all of that code. Okay, so add some space in here. I'm going to grab our group. Okay, so because it expects a group, you'll notice here that it's going to be a group of enumerable items. Okay, so each one of these, essentially what we're going to be data binding to our long list selector is a enumerable of t. That makes sense. So it's a collection of a collection of t. Right? So this group is our collection of t. Okay, and we're going to have an enumerable of these groups. Okay. So this group object has a number of items. Okay. It has a key property. Okay. And it's got a number of properties here that we're going to use to data bind to change behavior and change the visuals depending on whether the group has any items or not. Okay, because if you're familiar with the jump list on the core platform, when you go to and you click on A and you see the alphabet pane come up, if you don't have a Z, it's dimmed out. Okay, so that's the type of behavior that we want to replicate. So our group, we need to expose a property that says, okay, have we got any items in this group? Okay, because we need to be able to toggle that behavior. So that's why we have these visibility properties. And then of course support get enumerator as well. Okay, so let's introduce the value converter. Okay, so group converter. And so what we're going to be doing with this value converter is converting from just a raw list of items. Okay, so let me just put a couple of breaks in here. So we're going to get in a collection of items. Okay, so this thing here, this list of items, this item here. So that's the value that's going to come into our value converter. Okay, we're going to take that and we're going to apply a link expression based on a key value. Okay, so we're literally going to, and what we've done here is the parameter that comes in, okay, we're going to set a value converter parameter. It's going to come in, we're going to use that to determine what property on the items we're going to query to group on. Okay, so basically we're going to be invoking the key property. Okay, so this key property is actually essentially a reference to the property. Okay, we're going to invoke that, find out what the value is, we're going to look at the first letter in it, okay, and we're going to group by that. Okay, this bit of code down the bottom here ensures that we have every letter in the alphabet. Okay, because at the moment, when we group on things like that, we're only going to get the letters in the alphabet that we have items for. Okay, by doing this and doing from letter in alphabet, and the alphabet is defined up here, okay, we're going to ensure that we get an item we get a group, even if it's an empty group, for every item in the alphabet. All right. So the nice thing about these is that we can literally pass it any data source, right? So any list we can basically data bind to. So I'm going to come into here. I'm actually going to force a build. I'm going to come back to our properties. I'm going to do item source, data binding. Okay, so this item source property was what happened when we dragged on the design time data onto our list, and that we then subsequently copied across onto the long list selector. Down here under value converter, I'm going to go, okay, give me a new list to group list converter. And I'm going to tell it that I want to look at the comment property. Remember, in our design time data, we had image URL and we had comment. Okay, so we're going to group by the comment field. So I'm going to say comment in there. Okay, we've actually got content appearing back in there, which is all good. What we don't have is we don't have the markers for the beginning of each section in the list. So we don't have the A, the B, C, etc., which will give us the ability to jump out to the jump list. Okay, so we need to go and style those. And you'll notice that the long list selector, in addition to your regular item template, has actually got a number of group properties, okay, so or group templates. So we're going to have to do a couple. So we want the group header template. Okay, so this is the header item that's going to appear at the beginning of each group in the main list. Okay, so let's go edit header, create empty, yep. And this is actually where I'm going to do a bit of a shortcut. I've got some XAML here that's going to do this. So I'll show you the XAML, and what we'll see is that it updates the design as such. Okay, so you can actually, if you look at this, and I'm happy to give you the source for this, what we're binding to here is the text block is actually bound to the key name. And if you were quick enough to actually see our code here for the group, we had a property called key name. Okay, so that's essentially what we're grouping on. Okay, so what's what we're going to be showing. The other thing we're going to do is jump out of there. Okay, so now we've got the individual headers in each of the groups. We actually need it something for it to jump to when we click on it. Okay, so there's two things we need to set for the actual panel that we're going to be using. The first is we actually want to control how each of them renders. Okay, so our group item template basically indicates what's going to be on the screen for each item in each group that's in on the jump list. So let's go create empty for that. Okay. And notice that Blend tries to do a bit of a design experience. And again, I'm going to grab a snippet of XAML for you. And just drop this in. And as I was indicating before, okay, so we've got this sort of square-shaped thing. What I indicated before is that we're data binding to a number of those properties that like has items visibility and has no items visibility. And the reason why this is slightly more complex than you'd imagine is because we're trying to turn on and off panels to basically give us that effect so that, you know, for the items that or for the groups where we do have items, we've got it nicely in the accent color. And for those groups where we don't have items, we've got like a shaded gray. So not just the background color, not hidden items. We've still got the item there, but it's all shaded out. Okay, and you'll notice that we've done things like the is hit test visible is actually set to has items. Okay, the reason why we want to do that is because if somebody taps on Z and I don't have any items in Z, I don't want that list to respond. Like, I don't want the jump list to respond to it. Okay, so it's important that we data bind those up as well. So the last thing we need to do is actually modify the group items panel. Okay, and essentially the same way as when we modified the list box and we had the items panel for that. It's the same thing, but for the jump list. Okay, so basically you can see here that each item's being presented in a stack panel. We're going to change that over to, in this case, we're going to use a wrap panel. And the reason I'm copying this across is only just because I get it gives me the margin properties that I need to make it look good as well. Okay, so wrap panel is going to wrap horizontally. That's fine. Let's jump out of there. And what we should see when we run this up now is that we should have a jump list. So there's our header items. Okay, let me jump on there. And now we've actually got a fairly native looking experience for that jump list. Okay, all it was just a couple of lines of XAML. Okay, so I can if I click on ones that I don't have items, nothing happens. If I click on one that does have items, it goes through to here. Now, to make this a truly native experience, one of the things that we're missing is when I tap on an item, I should get some visual feedback. Okay, so I should get it should tilt for me. Okay, now there's a thing called the tilt effect that's part of the Silverlight toolkit. So when I actually tap on them, it actually gives me the ability to, it will actually tilt the item. That's easily applied to the list as a whole. What's slightly harder is actually applying it to this grid. Okay, it doesn't happen out of the box. The other thing that's weird is when I scroll this, it shouldn't scroll up and down. Okay, if you've actually used the hub and actually clicked on the the jump list there. It doesn't scroll up and down. This was actually a bug that we actually found in, after the Qantas app shipped. You know, we went through, what, 12 months of development to get this thing right, and yeah, there are always bugs, right? And there's always things that you can improve on. And this was one that actually got past us, and we, you know, were playing around with it the other day, and it was like, this list isn't supposed to do this. Yeah, and the main reason for that is that out of the box, it's designed to scroll, right? Because it's designed to be a vertical stack, okay? To stop it scrolling is actually a little hard, okay? Let me just flip over to Visual Studio, and we'll actually show you a couple of these things. These are one of the few things that I will actually add in the XAML. If you don't, if you're not already familiar with this shortcut, Control KD can do a reformat of the code for you. Okay, so you can see that I've formatted my code a little bit nicer. Just makes it easier to parse. And I'm going to come right down here to my long list selector, and I'm going to say, actually, I think I've got this. Oh, I don't have the tilde effect there. Yeah, tilde. Okay, so I'm going to enable the toolkit, and while I'm here, I'm going to do it on the hub tile as well. So that's given us the ability to do it on the main list. You still won't get that behavior on the jump list. So the other thing we're going to do is actually wire up some event handlers to... excuse me. Group view opened and group view closed. So these are the events that actually gets triggered when you go from being in the regular list to actually jumping out into the jump list. Let's go to navigate to those, and I'm going to drop in a bit of block of code because you don't want to watch me type. So essentially, we're doing a couple of things here. The first one is that we're going to go through the tiltable items and add in a specific type. Okay, so now the reason why we're doing this is because out of the box, one of the things that you can set is that there's this static list called tiltEffect.tiltableItems, and you can basically set that to make any item tiltable. The problem is, if you set the grid to be tiltable, for example, every single grid that you possibly have all of a sudden becomes tiltable. And what that means is if you've actually got a list of items that you've got a grid as the item template, those ones now have two tilt effects applied to them so that they don't tilt properly and you get some weird behaviors, right? So you don't actually want the grid to be as part of the tiltable items all of the time. So what we're doing is dynamically adding, and you'll see in the bottom code down here, that we're actually removing that same type from there. Now, because we want this code to be relatively flexible, we're not actually prescribing what type is in there, so I'm not automatically adding just the grid. I'm basically saying, okay, give me the first item in the container for each item. Okay, so it's actually interrogating the item template and saying, okay, what's the parent item there? Now, in our case, we just lay down with a grid. So it's going to add that grid type into the tiltable items. Okay. The other thing we're doing down here is we're also applying the tilt effect to each of the items in the list. Lastly, we're also disabling the vertical scroll bar as part of that that long list panel. So when we run this, what we'll see is we'll actually see that our jump list has now got the tilt effect. And when we go through to the main jump list, we'll see that no longer moves around. And what you should see is that these items are tiltable. Now, for whatever reason, in the simulator, these items don't tilt particularly well. There you go. The F is actually tilting a little bit. One thing you can do, though, is you can actually stretch out the items a little bit more to actually give you slightly more or less tilt behavior depending on the size of them. Okay, so that's a way around that problem to make it more tiltable. Right. So I think you've seen enough Blend for one day. Don't worry, we will probably come back and do some more later on. Let me just my slides back up. It's the whole visuals is something to do with PowerPoint and the way it interacts with the screen, I think. Huh. Oh, there we go. All right, so you've seen the Silverlight toolkit. Just a reminder about the behavior that we're really trying to get to with the long list selector, okay, and how the group converter actually means that we've still got that design time experience. We're still working with the design time data. Even when I ran up the application, we're still using the design time data. Right, so that's going to be our next thing to tackle is, okay, the demo we saw, actually I merged the two demos into one, is it blendable? Okay, it's super critical that your application remains blendable. The reason being is even if you're not a designer, that separation of concern between what happens on the visual and your underlying code, like the view model and the model and stuff like that, if you can provide that level of separation, it promotes testability, it means that you can hand off the UX to a designer or somebody who knows Blend. It means you can have multiple people working on the design versus the back end as well. So there's a whole bunch of benefits. It's not just a gimmick. Okay. So we're going to connect up some data. We are going to use the Windows Azure mobile services. I'm going to show you a Windows 8 example that they basically publish to actually interact with it. And the reason why I'm going to show you that is so that I can show you Fiddler and show you the JSON calls that go back and forward. Okay. From there, I'll show you the library that we built. It's a very simple wrapper library. It's not production ready, but it is available for people who want it. I'm more than happy to share the source code if you want it as well. I want to call out a couple of things about the mobile services that you might not be aware of. This thing called dynamic schematization is basically the ability to change the schema of tables on the fly, and some of the service interceptors that you can use to basically intercept update request or insert request that can be quite convenient. And this comes back to the voting part of that geek or nerd. Okay, so when people vote, you don't want them to be able to vote multiple times. So I'll show you some script that we do on the server side that basically goes and works out whether the person's voted previously and doesn't allow them to vote a second time. Okay, so Windows Azure mobile services. Let me go and create one. Okay, mobile services. So this is the new Windows Azure portal if you haven't already seen it. It's actually quite well constructed. Let's go and create a new mobile services. So we're going to call this, sounds like Windows Phone. We're actually going to create a new SQL database. Let me just grab that name as well. And we're actually going to put it on a new server. So a new database server. And I'll call this demo. And it actually requires quite a strong password. Let's make sure I try and get those the same. Right. And click OK. And it will go off and start creating our mobile service. And it will come back in a couple of seconds. And a couple more seconds. Okay, there we are. Done. Okay, so in here, this is basically the portal for manipulating it. If you flip over to the data column, it says you have no tables. Right, so let's go through their suggested getting started. Let's go and create a new Windows 8 application, and it gives you this option to create a to-do item table. We'll do this just so that I can run up the sample app and show you around, and then we're going to come back and actually create our own table. So we'll download the C# language example. And I'll go, yep, let's just save that. Let's open the folder. Let's unblock it. And we're going to go extract all. And we're just going to open this in Visual Studio. And while that's loading, I'm going to launch Fiddler. Okay. And so the latest version of Fiddler actually supports debugging Metro apps, which is kind of cute. And very useful. So let's run up our sample application. And we're going to go and create a new item. Now, before we do this, let's just flip it back to the mobile services. Remember I said that there was no data table before? It's currently a to-do item table. If I click through to there, what you'll see is that there in this table there are no records. Okay, but if I flip to columns, there's only a single column in here as well, ID. Okay. Hang on, but that's not going to be very useful. So this is where this whole schema, dynamic schematization, for want of a better word, kicks in. So if I click save on this, it's going to go ahead and actually create this new item. If I flip back to here and actually refresh on here, what you'll see is it's actually introduced a new column in there for us. So it's done text, okay, so that's the text of the to-do item, and it's got a completed, which is a Boolean flag. If we actually look across here at Fiddler, we'll grab this item. Actually, I'm going to stop this running now. And what you see here, and I do apologize for this font size, is basically this is the HTTP POST request that's actually been sent from the application across up into the mobile services to actually create that record. And you'll see that it's basically got two properties, one of which is a text and one of which is a Boolean value that actually goes and introduces and creates those columns. So if I actually grab another item or put another item in here, another column, well, let's just call it another, and put some text in there and execute this code again, okay, what we'll see when I refresh this is that we now have another property, another element in there. Can anybody think that this would be a recipe for disaster? Yes, you can turn it off. Okay. So the idea here is that it's designed so that you could rapidly build up your application, test it, get it ready for publishing, and then once you're happy with it, you turn off this dynamic schematization so that people can't intercept it with Fiddler like I've just done and go, oh, I'm so clever, I'm going to add another couple of columns into your data table. Right? Now, the other things that we can do in here is if I actually look at the return value here, what you'll see in here is that the return value is actually the same JSON object, so the same code that we actually supplied. This time it comes back with an ID property on it, ID of 2. Okay, so maybe what happens is when I do different HTTP verbs, I get different things. Okay, so for example, I can come in here and actually delete. Okay, so given that that second entry was 2, chances are if I do 1, it's going to execute that. It's going to come back, it's going to basically come back with a 204, which is no content, which you'd expect after a delete operation, right? If I go back up here and actually look at my content in the browse, you'll actually see that my second record is there, but I've actually deleted the first one. Okay, if I change this to, for example, a patch operation. Now, if you've worked with OData, you'll be familiar with doing an update via put. Okay, this is one difference to that. They've actually chosen to use a patch. The reason being is that you can update only one part of the object, and the correct HTTP verb for that is a patch, not a put. Okay, so I can basically come in here and say, okay, well, actually, the result of this is actually going to be true now. And I'm going to say this is item number 2. Execute that, get a 200 back, which is correct. And if I actually change and browse again, what we should see is that that completed is now true. Okay, so you can literally control all of these from the REST API. Let's go back and actually create our own table this time. Okay, so sounds like my phone. Let's go to our data. Let's go and create a table. So we do photo. And notice you can modify the permissions. I'm not going to, but you can actually control permissions on these tables so that some random can't go in and delete all your records. And so we're going to go and create that photo. Okay. And again, this table will be created with only a single ID column. And in fact, there is no UI for actually creating additional columns. You actually need to do it via the dynamic schematization. So let's go back to to Fiddler. And so what we can do here is actually change this to be a post, and we'll change the table to be photo, because that was our new table. And we're going to create this with the same named columns that we're going to expect in our code. So we're going to do comment, this is an awesome photo, and image URL. Just grab an image URL that I know exists, and we're just going to drop this one in here and execute that one. And image URL. Oh. So 201 back, which is good. Okay, so now in theory, our to-do table, our photo table should have those two additional columns, which it does. Comment, image URL, boom, we're all good to go. Right, so now we've got an opportunity to go back to our code and actually start to wire things up. So let's come up here, and we're going to try and do this the correct or a better way, rather than just writing the code directly into the code behind in our file. Let's go and create a new project, class library. This is going to be our data project. Okay, and we're going to change this, and we're going to say rename to main view model. Yes, I would like to rename the class. I'm going to implement iNotify property changed, so we can bubble up events. And Notice Resharper kicks in and gives me some nice event handler stuff. And of course, we've then got to expose a list of these property items. Okay, so let's go ahead and create. Create and load. So we're going to create our Azure mobile service. Okay, but hang on, you haven't introduced this concept. Okay, what we need to do in our data class is actually go and manage our NuGet package. Remember I said that I've got a published wrapper for this. So Azure mobile services, install. Let's go and add that. And now we should be able to reference that. We're going to load using the async keyword. Okay, so we're going to load that dynamically. This is expecting some photos. Okay, so we're actually going to have to go and create this photo class. Let's create that class. And so this class should mirror what we've got on the web. So data contract. Okay, and we're going to attribute it. So, and this is going to be our image URL. Now, the important thing here is that what we put in the data member has to match what's actually in the column, what the column was called. So remember we called that image URL all lowercase versus what the property is called, which has to marry up with what we use in the design experience. So remember when we did the designer, we did image URL, capital I, capital U. We need to make sure that matches our property, okay, because we're going to be using data binding for those. The other one is our comment. So again, string comment with a capital C. Okay, so there's our photo object. And of course, we're going to need an actual photos property up here. And up here, we're going to go prop full. And this is going to be a photo array, photos. And of course, we need to raise this notification event as well. So on property changed, photos. All right. So the only thing we're missing here is it's whinging about this to array, and that's because I need to actually include the system.link namespace. Okay, so essentially here, this code here, ignore this commented code, we're going to create an instance of our mobile service, okay, and we need to provide it a couple of parameters. So we need to give it an ID, which is essentially a unique identifier that the mobile service is used to identify each request coming in, and the name of the service, which actually determines the URL. Okay, so if we come back over to Fiddler, we can see that we've got these items actually included in here. So it's basically our application is actually as part of that. We'll pull that out and put it as the ID. And our URL sounds like WP. Okay, so we'll grab that out and put that as our name. Okay, so this is all well and good. This is part of our view model. Of course, we actually need to wire this up as part of our page. So let's go back to our page. We're going to go into here, and we're going to say data context equals new main view model. Reference data, yep. Okay, and then, of course, we actually need to call the load data method. So we're going to do override on navigate to. Data context as main view model dot load data. Okay, so it's basically saying here the build error is that you need to reference the async library. Okay, so currently with the Windows Phone tools, the ability to use the async and await keywords are packaged in as part of the async CTP that was available. It does have a runtime license. It is not supported, though, but it does give you the ability to write code now that's going to be forward compatible with Windows 8 and in theory, the Windows Phone vNext toolkit. So let's add a reference to that, courtesy of ReSharper, and we should be ready to go. So should be able to wrap that code. Okay. I always do this to myself. My designer has left my design experience in there. So let's go back over to here. Let's go to our project. Let's go and uncheck that enable design time. If you haven't already seen that, essentially what that does is in our code, what you'll see, let's pick our main item in here. There's this D colon data context. Okay, so basically toggling that flag on and off basically removes and adds that D colon prefix. So basically the D colon prefix basically means only read this at design time. Okay, So let's save that. Let's come back to Visual Studio. Let's reload and actually run this up. Put a breakpoint in there. Waiting. Okay, we've got one photo in there. Yay. Okay, let's run that and actually just check that it's in there. Okay, look at that awesome photo of a geek. Right, not particularly helpful in terms of our jump list because we've only got one item. So let's actually see whether we can actually link it to an existing service. So my code in here, I'm actually going to switch out the service that we just wired up and switch it to an existing one I have. The only difference is I need to actually say this to the blob, tile blob URL. So the name of the column is slightly different in there. So let's wire this up. And what we should see, and notice that the UI is completely responsive even though we're actually loading up data, okay, because all of that, the loading has been done off the UI thread. So we've actually got 45 objects in there now, which is good, good sizable chunk. So we've actually got some items appearing in our hub array, and we've got the ability to jump through some various items in there and scroll through them. Okay. So let's go back to our PowerPoint. Actually, what I'll just do is step through these rather than refresh the display again. Okay, so we've seen that we've done quite a good separation of concerns. Yes?
So you have this Azure Mobile Services in the model view. So people listening to the monospace and running in a different platform.
There wouldn't be. What I would probably do, I haven't. Yeah, it should just work because so the NuGet package that I downloaded is essentially just a DLL. I mean, it's just a native. You know, it's just a managed DLL. So in theory, what would happen is that I can actually take the DLL, like the main view where I've got the view model, take that DLL, take the DLL for the NuGet package, bring that across to and actually add it to my mono projects. The only thing that wouldn't work is that because there's no support for async at the moment, you need to work around that part of it. But that could be a matter of you just reworking the library. I mean, it's just making REST calls behind the scenes, so it's relatively straightforward stuff. Okay, so what we've seen there is that we do have we went down the view model path. The simplest option would, of course, be just to wire up some data to the list box itself. Okay, basically set the items property and we can wire up some data like that. That's not really good because, of course, we've then got a very tightly coupling between essentially the view model code, the code that's actually going to do our business logic, the fetching of the data and stuff like that, and actually how it's going to be presented. Now, if you go and talk to any iOS developer, and they'll get into the nitty-gritties of writing view controllers. And if you ever watch them write up code that actually binds to effectively a list, which they use a table view for, you'll see a big mismatch between code that's coming back from their servers versus code that's going to render to the UI, okay? This is really awesome stuff in terms of the separation of those two necks of the world, and it means that our code is very much more testable and easily testable, okay? So the properties are bound to the view, okay? So as part of our view, we're defining what the properties are that we're going to be data binding to. And of course, we need to make sure that we expose the iNotify property changed event so that it bubbles up properly. Now, if I had used an observable collection, there is another event that actually gets listened for, which is the iNotify collection change. So when you're data binding to a list or a list box, if you actually data bind just a static array, you can't dynamically add and remove things to it. Okay, if you were to data bind to an observable collection, the data binding framework goes, oh, I like this kind of a collection. I know that this one bubbles up this iNotify collection changed event to notify me when items are being added and removed and reset and moved and stuff like that in the collection. Okay, so if you're going to be data binding a collection of items to a list that is going to dynamically change, then I would highly recommend using the observable collection because it will allow you to dynamically add and remove items in your view model and for them to bubble up into the design experience. Okay, just a recap of the MVVM layers. This is what it's supposed to look like, right? So you're supposed to have your presentation, and I tried to make this point in my previous presentation when I was talking about the mono toolkits as well, is that you should be designing your view specific for the platform. So in this case, we're doing Windows Phone, so making sure that the views are pages and controls and things like that. And that you're using data binding, which is very, very much a loosely coupled relationship to your view models. Now, there's a big cross on the lines there. Now, this is not to say that you can't do two-way data binding. It's actually to say that your view model should never reach out to your page. Okay, so you should never have code there that says, this element on the page, I want to move it up and down 50 pixels. Okay, that's a big, big no-no. Okay, if you want to do that type of thing, you have a property that says, alignment or alignment shift or something like that in your view model, and you change that dynamically, okay? And then you have something in your UI that data binds to it, okay? So you should be changing properties or raising events in your view model that, and the event being iNotified property change, you should be bubbling up things like that to the UI in order to get the UI to actually make those changes. Of course, your view model is then bound to your data. Most of the stuff that we've been doing at the moment has actually been just hooking almost straight into, services and data, things like that. You can abstract it a little bit further. Like a lot of my projects, I end up having this thing called a repository. You can call it what you like, but this is basically the gate point for actually calling off to services, calling off to data. And the reason why I like having it going through the one thing is it means that I can reuse that same data amongst multiple models, and I can actually have it as my cache, and I can do a lot of funky stuff because I know everything's going through those one places. I've seen people who don't particularly like that model and actually would prefer to have their own repository or their own data access layer for each of their view models. It depends on the complexity of your application. Okay, the other nice thing about, and I mentioned this before about data binding, is it does mean that you can then test your view models. Because you don't have that code that reaches out to your view and says, okay, well, I'm expecting it to be coupled to this view, I'm always expecting that view to be there, it means it's much more testable. Okay, so it means that we can wire it to some test code, spin up a new instance of this view model, train some properties on it, call some methods on it, and we can test what the expected behavior is going to be. Okay. A little bit of a recap of data binding in XAML. I hope most of you are familiar with this. If not, then I apologize. We'll go through this relatively quickly. So the basic syntax for doing anything that is not a raw property value is to have these curly brackets. Okay, basically, that's telling the framework to basically, this is a calculated property, and that you've got to go and do some additional work. Okay, so there are a couple of other things other than the word binding. They're the static resource that will actually go look for a static resource that's defined elsewhere. Binding, in this case, will actually go looking for a property value as defined by the path. Now, in most cases, the syntax is abbreviated, so instead of writing path equals line 3, it's simplified down to just line 3. Okay, so the full syntax would be curly brackets binding space path equals line 3. Okay, now most people just drop the path in preference of the simpler format like that. Okay, so but this is a property on the data source or the data context of this element. Most cases, you don't set the data context. The data context is quite often set much further up in the visual tree, and it just bubbles down. The reason being is that in most cases, you don't need to set the data context. You can actually do cascading properties. So you might have, myObject.blah.blah.line3, okay? And the framework is intelligent enough to realize that every time it sees a dot, it's got to go and traverse one further down the property tree, okay? And the nice thing about that is if any of those objects implement iNotify property change, it will also wire into those, right? So if any part of that chain changes, it will go and refresh that particular item. So it's a really powerful engine, and they've done a really good job of it. Okay, just be aware that there is a little bit of a performance overhead if you do very complex things with the data binding, but there are some opportunities to obviously simplify that and rationalize it out. Okay, the other thing that it exposes are the modes. Okay, so if you have input fields, you'll quite often want to set the mode. So in this case, we're setting it to two-way. And I did actually made a subtle change in here from being a text block to being a text box, because the text block wouldn't accept two-way binding. Well, it would, but you'd just never be able to change anything on it. The text box, quite often you want two-way. One warning about the text box is that it, whilst it does support two-way binding, you have to actually leave the text box in order for it to refresh down the underlying data source, which can cause problems if you're expecting users to enter text and then hit the app bar. Okay, the reason being is that when they click the app bar, it doesn't take the focus away from that text box, so it doesn't commit the change value to the underlying data source. So one thing that you might have to do there is you basically trap the text change property event and actually tell it to refresh the binding underneath. So every time they enter something, it's refreshing the binding. I actually abstract this away into a behavior, okay, which I can literally drag off my assets in Blend and actually apply to every single text box. Okay. Or the other option is you create your own text box that wraps the normal text box that has that default behavior built into it. Okay. They did it for performance reasons in Silverlight. Of course, the phone team then forgot to work out that they should actually lose focus when they click on the app bar. Okay, iNotify property change. Okay, this is the basic implementation that comes out of the box. Again, quite often I will actually have a base class that actually provides this this method and the event, and then all my subsequent code then calls into it. There are also some nicer ways of actually calling it. So like I've got an overload that basically takes in a property expression tree. So all of a sudden it gets rid of these string literals that you see in your code and replaces it with a property. Okay, so you can basically, my overload of this notify property change method actually will interrogate the expression tree, work out what the method, the property is that you're calling, and actually substitute it in there for you. Okay, and that gives you really good compile time support for actually making sure that you don't make any boo-boos. The one part of the data binding framework that is a little brittle and sensitive is that part where you notify, you bubble up those property change events. If you bubble up a property change and the property doesn't exist, the whole framework falls over and goes, nah, sorry, I can't deal with that. Which is interesting because if you data bind to a property that doesn't exist, it goes, that's fine, I'm just not going to show any data for you. So it's brittle in one case but not in the other. Okay, so we've actually seen the MVVM data binding. What I wanted to go through is actually talking about some of the more advanced side of things. So firstly, actually using commanding to actually bubble up events from the UI actually into your view model. I actually don't prescribe to this. I don't use commands very often. The reason being is that I just see it as an overload that is a little unnecessary. So what I do is I normally will bubble up my events into the code behind and then call properties call methods on the view model. It only introduces one line of code into your code behind. Those purists out there will do command binding. Okay, so it looks a bit like this. Okay, so you essentially on a command, on a button that actually supports the command property, just 2 seconds, you can basically just data bind straight to it. For events that don't that are not commands, you can actually use something like this, which basically says, okay, an event trigger, it's going to bind to the particular event name, and actually Blend supports this quite well, so you can actually do the design time support for it. My preference is I don't particularly like this much XAML. I find it easier just to write the event handler and then call into the view model. So I don't see it adding a huge amount of value. The downside of it is that you actually need to generate a chunk of code in your view model to generate these relay commands or these entry points into there. And I just see that this is being overly complex and additional code that I have to write for every single entry point, right? I could just have a method that gets called. So I don't actually prescribe to using this much stuff, although the purest MVVM people out there will say, oh, you've got to do that because you shouldn't have any code in your code behind file. Okay, sorry, there was a question right here.
Is it also because for like multi-portable? So if you don't have to write a relay command, you can...
Well, the relay command is actually just an implementation, right? So you can have your own implementation that will be cross-platform as well. So you can still do that, and that's not a particularly strong reason to not use it. It's actually personal preference, really. The purists out there have a hard line of no code in your code behind. The reality with Windows Phone and actually nearly every other platform is that you'll need to do some level of UI manipulation yourself at some point. Okay, so you're never going to get away with no code in the code behind unless you do an awful lot of work. Okay, so I mentioned this in my previous talk, is that one of the other problems that is introduced with all of these mobile platforms is that there's a very strong tie-in between the UI and the platform and how it does navigation. So, for example, in Windows Phone, there's this navigation service that actually belongs to the frame and is exposed into the pages as this navigation service that you then call in order to go from one page to another. And the problem with this is if we're doing all of our logic in our view model, then we actually need to work out, okay, so they've entered some text, they hit the button, and we want to go to the next page. How are we going to get that back into the view without reaching into the view and actually say, hey, navigate to this next page, okay? So realistically, what we want to be able to do is actually navigate from one view model to another view model and for the UIs to magically do their own thing and actually update for us. Okay, so we kind of need to abstract this into this thing called a navigation service. It really basically provides a level of abstraction so we're not reaching back out of our view models into our view, right? Yep?
Can you use like a nested view models rather than the same model?
Sorry?
Can you use nested view models?
Yes, you can. Yeah, you can if you want. So one option that quite often comes up, not so much with phone because the UI is fairly small, but in terms of doing big Windows development, is that you'll have one view model that's for the full page, and then you have smaller view models that might be bound to either user controls or smaller elements within the page. Yeah, absolutely, you can do that. There's no problems. I mean, essentially, view model is a fancy word for a class, all right? I mean, I'm not one of these big people that says, oh, use MVVM for everything. It's not the holy grail, right? It's actually just a code word for data binding at the end of the day, right? So this part of things, so the downside of the view model actually reaching into the view, of course, is we get strongly coupled into the view, which means it's very hard to test, okay? If we can abstract this away into this thing called a navigation service and actually provide an in-between layer there that we can expose as an interface, then all of a sudden we can again go back to being testable. Okay, so we have an interface for the navigation service. We have an implementation for Windows Phone, and we would do the same thing if we were building for iOS or Android. Right? We could potentially have an implementation for those. We could expose those to our view model, and then the view model can call it to say, hey, navigate to the next page. Okay. So such an implementation might look a bit like this. Okay. And so that's going to give us our the ability to navigate to a page. Now, what I don't particularly like about this implementation is it is still very URI-based. Okay, I'd like to say, okay, just navigate to this particular type. So one of the things I do in the code that I write is my iNavigation service actually has a type parameter on there rather than a specific URI, and I'll actually go ahead and actually register the types that I want to navigate to as part of that. Okay, so when I call the navigate to, I actually give it a type. And behind the scenes, I have a dictionary of types that maps from the types to the individual pages. Now, there's a couple of options there. You can either have a static dictionary of them, or you can actually use a URI mapper as part of the actual application itself to map from those types to the destination page.
How do you then handle it in one view model to have two different
presented? You don't. So I have a strong coupling between my view, like in that context. My opinion is that the view models represent the current state of a view, right? So I will have a view and a view model. They're not tightly coupled in the sense of being able to call to and from each other, but they're tightly coupled in the sense that I will only use them as a pair, right? So if you need to reuse things beyond that, that's when you have a model or a repository or whatever you like to call it, where you reuse the code at that level rather than actually necessarily within the view models. Or you break things out again into sort of base classes and things like that. Actually, one project we're working on at the moment, we do just that. We actually have a base view model class that actually has a lot of the implementation for surfacing up properties and things like that. And then we reuse it and make a specific view model for each of the pages that we're then going to use. All right. So let me just talk about... we'll skip over most of this stuff. For those who are familiar with dependency injection, what you can see here is, of course, as we go... and actually start using this thing called a navigation service. We obviously want a way to inject it, okay? So I'm basically going to have a view model that has things like a data service, a navigation service. To try and keep that independence from the actual view, we can inject those, and which gives us the ability to then mock it out as part of our testing. Okay. Sorry? None. The reason being is that, so this thing, which is the one which ships with MVVM Lite, okay, and the reason why I'm using it as an example is just to point out that you can use a dependency injection framework container if you'd like. The reason I don't like it is because you're going register, 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 call it and insert the values there, right? When are you ever going to call it other than via the constructor? And the reality is that you don't need a dependency injection framework for this stuff. If you do, then you could actually create half of these instances as resources for your application anyhow. So, again, this is one of those things that I don't really prescribe to. I don't think phone projects are big enough to warrant or need an IOC container of this nature. Is that a fair enough answer? Yep. Right. Dave, do you want to serve up USB sticks? Okay. So just in close, talking about testing, there is this Silverlight unit testing framework with continuous integration. Let me just show you there's some various unit testing meta tags. So they're very similar to the ones that you'd expect if you've used MS test. And let's see an example of it. So again, this is just our test method. In this case, we're creating up a mock data service and passing it in as part of a mock navigation service to this view model. Okay, we're then setting a few things, calling initialize, and then we're just asserting the behavior on it. Okay, let's see if we can quickly just run through an example of this. So let me just go and create a new project. To run this up on for Windows Phone, you actually do need to create a separate testing application. Okay. And in here, we're going to go manage NuGet, and we're going to go continuous integration, install. Close. Okay, so, and you'll see here it's added this text file. And so this little bit of chunk of code we actually need to copy into our main page. And just throw that into there. So in the loaded event, just update the references. And this is basically going to give us our test pages. Okay, so it's going to go and interrogate the things that we want to test. Of course, we actually need to set this as a startup project. We need to add in a test class. So let's go and add in a test main view model. Yes. And we're going to attribute that as test class. Yeah. You don't really want to see me type this stuff. Let's go and grab that. Okay. We're going to create a reference to. It's not main page view model, it's main view model. Reference that. Load the data. It's whinging about the async stuff as well, so let's add a reference to that. And let's go and run that. Okay, so running the project, basically, let's just tell it to run everything. And you see it's gone ahead and run our test load data method. Okay, the nice thing about this, and the reason why I'm using the continuous integration thing off NuGet, is if I start a command prompt. And one thing to watch if you've got 2012 installed, you do need to make sure you grab the 2010 command prompt, otherwise it won't work properly. Let's actually also grab the path of this particular project. Let's go there. So this is the path of the test project, not the path of the solution. MS build, tell it what target. Okay, so we want to do a test one. Okay, what we should see is that it's going to spin up the application in the emulator. If you don't have the emulator running, it will open up the emulator. It will deploy the package to the emulator. It will run the package in the emulator. It will pull off the data, and you can see that it's run the test cases there. And it's thrown a WinGP because it's actually broken, build failed. But it will report errors back into the UI, sorry, back into here. So I can go cd bin slash debug slash test. Results, okay, and there is your XML output from those test cases that you can then wire back into your testing framework and your continuous integration. Yes?
I just noticed you use async in here, and Windows Phone 7 is still in 2010, isn't it?
Correct.
Using version 4?
Yes, so in order to get this stuff to work, you need the async library, or the async CTP library, still. So the UI will automatically flow through all of those tests, so you don't actually need to manually do it. In terms of UI testing, there's not really. I mean, some of the basic UI testing will actually work with the emulator. So you, but basically, it needs to rely on the emulator being in the right spot and actually clicking through it. So there's nothing really out there for actually managing it. It does not have separate window handles for each individual element there because it's a virtual machine. All right, so
if add the 4.5 CDP into the actual window phone to actually use.
No, you can't. You need to use the version 4 one. So, hello.
Would that work running under team build with a non-interactive service?
You'll need to have the interactive service running in order for it to run. Yes, and you need to have the Windows SDK installed. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
It's not great from a build perspective, but that's the best we can do. We are officially out of time, so thank you all for coming. I don't want to eat into your morning tea break, but I will be around if you want to serve up some other questions. And I have got a ton of these USB sticks. We didn't give away the phone, so I encourage you to come back to the next session where they hopefully will have more time and they'll give away the phone. Did I get away with that? Thanks, guys. I'm done.
I'm ready to go tonight.